Disclaimer. Judge Ron Rengel is providing this podcast and website for educational purposes only, as well as to give the public general information regarding topics related to the criminal justice system. The views, thoughts, and opinions of his guest speakers are the speaker's own and do not represent the views, thoughts, and opinions of Judge Rengel. All rise. You are now listening to Beyond the Gavel with Judge Ron Rengel, educating the public and expanding mindsets. Subscribe on our website, beyondthegavelpodcast.com, or your favorite podcast platform for more of the latest podcast episodes and updates.
Welcome to Beyond the Gavel with Judge Ron Rengel. I'm your host. Today in the studio, we have somebody very different than we've had in the past. Vanessa Sandoval was born and raised in San Antonio on the west and the northwest side of town. She graduated from San Antonio College in 2016 with her associate's degree in liberal arts and anthropology, and more recently graduated from the University of Texas in San Antonio in 2021 with her bachelor's degree in anthropology and Mexican American studies. She spends her time cycling, reading, volunteering, and preparing to apply to graduate school. Welcome, Vanessa.
Thank you for having me, Judge. It's an honor to be here and to be in conversation with you again.
Oh, it's an honor to have you. Do you want to tell the listeners why we're having a conversation again?
Sure. I participated in the Felony Mental Health Pretrial Diversion Program, and I am a recent graduate of the program.
We started in Bexar County the very first mental health specialty court on the felony level a couple of years ago, and we've only had a few graduates. You are one of those graduates.
Yes.
And you were very successful.
Thank you.
Let's talk about your story. First, let's hear a little bit about where it was that you were raised. You told us that you're from the west and northwest sides of town. What high school did you go to?
I graduated from Holmes High School.
Mm-hmm. Were you raised by parents, family members?
My parents were together for most of my childhood, all of my childhood. They separated when I was in high school. But I grew up with them, grew up with my grandparents. I do a lot of volunteer work on the west side of town, in the historic west side of town. So that's where my dad still lives to this day. So that's where all my volunteering goes.
So when you say volunteer work, you're talking about sort of like the Guadalupe Cultural Arts Center.
Yes, the Esperanza Peace and Justice Center.
Right. For folks that are listening, what exactly does the Esperanza Peace and Justice Center do?
They are a culturally relevant, culturally sustaining nonprofit. Mm-hmm. They bring cultural programming to community. They preserve historic West Side sites.
So when you say cultural programming, I know there's plays that they put on, there's festivals that they have.
Festivals, concerts, they have their Noche Azul.
So if I wanted to participate, what would I do?
Well, for me, I'm old school. I kick it old school. I would go into the building and see, you know, let them know I'm a volunteer, that I'm anxious to volunteer and to see what would.
Is that building located at Guadalupe and Brazos Street?
Yes, it is.
That's a beautiful building.
Yes, it is.
So you go into that building, you kind of see what they're doing, and they'll have volunteer opportunities for anybody that's interested.
Yes.
So you've always been interested in cultural art.
That's right.
You got a degree in anthropology.
Yes.
What exactly does a study of anthropology mean?
Anthropology has four disciplines. There's linguistics, the study of language, cultural anthropology, which is what I do, bioanthro, which is the forensic side of things, and then archaeology. So I took the cultural route and just the study of looking at different cultures. It could be the culture of anything, not necessarily across the sea or anything. It could be the culture of gaming. It could be the culture of law. It could be the culture of policing.
Right. So you went to Holmes High School. How did you do when you were at Holmes?
I did A's and B's, but I had, you know, we are talking about mental health here. I grew up with a lot of trauma that I experienced. So in high school, too, I acted out. A lot of those traumas were fresh. So I did act out. So I did spend some time in alternative school, but I graduated in the 4 years that, you know, that I was supposed to. And I did walk the stage. But I had some unchecked mental health back then, too.
So back then, high school, you had a mental health diagnosis.
Yes.
What was that?
That was, I believe at the time, it was bipolar personality.
How did that manifest itself?
It manifested itself in ways that I was very combatant with authority figures.
And I guess the combative thought process you went through was related to growing up, some of the things that you experienced.
Right.
You want to tell us a little bit about that?
Sure. You know, I was abused. I was sexually abused when I was from the age of 4 to the age of 14. And then still in high school, when I was 16, my grandparents were murdered. It was a double homicide. So I almost had like two different traumas that I was dealing with, because I did come out and tell my parents about the sexual abuse when I was 13 or 14 years old. So I was just going into, I was just going into high school.
So when you told your parents, were they supportive? Did you feel like they listened to you? Did they act on your behalf?
Yes, they did. They listened to me. They believed me, which was really important, because I know other people don't have that same kind of situation. My parents were very supportive. CPS did get involved. It was a lot. It was a lot for my family to go through. But from that came the diagnosis of borderline personality. And I had my struggle with authority was that we are told as children, you know, that respect your elders and listen to your elders. But look where that got me in that particular incident. And I took that and applied it to the rest of, you know, my life. And it manifested itself in me being very combatant towards authority figures.
Did your experience result in a case with the criminal justice system?
It did. Things that I remember, things that I don't remember, the perpetrator did see jail time, very, very little jail time. But I remember taking a tour of the courtroom, and the tour was for children who might have to testify.
Yes.
So they were showing us how the courtroom is built. And when you're sitting in the witness chair, it kind of hides you from the defendant, because we're also small bodies. But they said that it was made that way so that we wouldn't have to face the defendant.
How old were you when you had to go through that experience of touring the courtroom, preparing to testify, meeting with prosecutors?
I was 13, 14, between the ages of 13 and 16.
Looking back, do you feel that the system handled your case in a way? I mean, obviously your parents were, as you said, supportive. So
yes,
obviously that was a big deal when it comes to your experience, right?
Yes.
I mean, that's really one of the biggest factors that anybody could have when they're victims of child sexual abuse, to have people in the family that they could rely on, that'll support them, that'll protect them. That's the most important thing that a child can see.
Right.
Did you feel that the system at that time manifested itself that way towards you?
Yes, I do.
How so?
I felt, when I was going through everything, I felt protected. I felt safe. I was so young. I felt that they were trying to get and discipline the bad guy. So yeah, I do.
And so then you were diagnosed with borderline personality disorder and bipolar disorder.
Yes.
You went through high school. You could see a lot of that because you were in high school, I guess, when that case came out.
Yes.
Into the court system.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So then after high school, what happened to you then?
After high school, I went straight to Northwest Vista, spent some years there. And then when I dropped out, and it was supposed to be a semester off, it turned into about 7 years, my 7 year semester off. That is when I got really involved with the Esperanza Peace and Justice.
Good.
And when I got really involved with the women that run Esperanza, and the interns that they have were all university students. So I was constantly around university students and constantly being told, you should go back to school, you should go back to school. 7 years later, I decided to take the leap and go back to school. And I returned and went to SAC, San Antonio College, and graduated from SAC in 2016, I believe, with a double degree, one in liberal arts and one in anthropology.
So you had some good support systems. You had positive friendships. You were involving yourself in the community in a
yes,
very positive way. And so you felt like you were going in the right direction.
Yes.
You ended up going back to college to the degree,
yes,
the associate's degree.
Yes.
And then you got into University of Texas at San Antonio.
Yes.
When was it that you got into UTSA?
I believe it was in 2016. Yeah. And I graduated in 2021.
What were you intending on doing with those degrees?
Continuing on to get my master's. And eventually the big goal is my PhD.
Very nice.
Yes.
Very nice. And you're still on that path.
I'm still on that path. It took a detour with the felony, but I'm still on that path.
And so you brought up the felony charge.
Yes.
So you had a felony case. That's how I met you.
Yes.
So let's talk about how that happened. So I guess you were charged with a felony. What was that?
The charge was terroristic threat. It sounds so scary, but that's what the official charge was, terroristic threat. That is the felony that I had. I say it was a misunderstanding. I really believe that it was a misunderstanding, but the other party that brought the charge didn't feel that way in the heat of the moment when it was over an email. Uh-huh. When I'm sending that email, it was at the height of a mental health episode. And even when I was being arrested and I was in handcuffs, I was still having a mental health episode, and I still could not wrap my head around how or why the felony was being brought about. Like in my head in that moment, there was no way that anyone could misunderstand the message that I had sent in the email.
So you said the other party didn't take it the way you thought you had sent it.
Right.
The other party was a police officer.
It was actually six different representatives from the university.
So there's an email that went out to folks that worked at the university.
Yes.
That represented the University of Texas at San Antonio.
Yes.
Had you already graduated from college at that time?
No, I didn't.
So you were still a student?
I was still a student.
You said it was terroristic threat. So terroristic threat is on the felony level, in some sort of threat of violence to somebody in certain positions. Is that what happened?
It was supposed to be a threat towards myself to end my own life. I included a picture of the gun and a hollow tip bullet, which I think that they really focused on that. I wrote UTSA on the bullet, and in the email, I alluded to suicide, and I said UTSA is going to be the last thing that goes through my head. And I meant the bullet, and that's why I wrote UTSA on the bullet. But the other side took it as a threat towards the campus or possible to people, parties on the campus. When I was being arrested and in handcuffs, it kind of, when they told me how the other side took it, I actually sent a follow-up email that I profusely apologized to those parties because I never intended them to take that as a threat towards them. And it broke my heart because I pride myself being a community builder. A peaceful person and a community builder. And it broke my heart that it could have been interpreted that way.
What is it that you were going through that brought you to that point?
It was family issues, actually. It was the Monday after Easter Sunday. And it was the first time that my siblings had given me an explanation of why I wasn't invited to family functions anymore. And basically, I was kicked out of the sibling group. They had already had stopped inviting me, but it was the first time when it was said out loud, like, this is why we are not inviting you anymore. Like, we don't want to, spend family functions with you anymore. That night, I was really, really sad and went out to the bar. I decided to handle, that sadness with going out drinking. I was with a friend who, my best friend, actually, trying to help me get through the day. So it was Easter Sunday. We went to the bar. We closed down the bar, continued drinking. We were smoking as well.
Smoking, meaning smoking marijuana?
Yes. Uh-huh. We were smoking marijuana, drinking. And when he left for the night, which was early morning, I was left alone with my own thoughts and drunk and sad and just kind of spiraled out of control from there. I attempted to call a crisis line, the UTSA crisis line, and I didn't really feel like I got anywhere with them. So after I hung up the phone with them, then I wrote the email.
So you went through your experiences and it was a family member that was a perpetrator, the individual that committed the crimes against you when you were a child.
Right.
So you have that going on. It was Easter Sunday, which is billed as a big day for families and people to get together. And then siblings, how many siblings do you have?
I have four siblings.
All right, so your siblings have sort of gotten together and said, we don't want to participate in family functions like Easter with you.
Right.
You went out, started using substances. You're going through an episode you call the UTSA health crisis line.
Right.
Which is what it's set up for, right? It's set up for students who are going through a crisis.
My lashing out with UTSA was a long history in the making, probably since 2017. But what set that particular email off was that I had a student code and conduct charge against me. And I don't remember exactly what it was for, but I felt that the university kept disciplining me for behaviors that I was showing when I was having a mental health crisis, but they were the ones exacerbating the mental health.
They weren't handling it correctly.
Right.
And were they aware about your grandparents as well? Was that in their files or whoever it is that you were speaking to at that time?
No.
All right. So you had been going through these issues. You sent this email. Next thing you know, you're getting arrested.
Yes.
How'd that happen?
I had blood work done at the Center for Healthcare Services. And I went to go do my blood work and I had not been taking my cholesterol medicine. So they told me that I was unable to do the blood work. And I had, this is the Monday morning after Easter Sunday as well. The email was sent, I think like at 6:30 in the morning. And by 9 a.m., I was in handcuffs and I had gone to do blood work and they said that I couldn't. And I expressed to them that I was feeling suicidal. And that's what got the police called in the first place, that I had expressed that I was suicidal because I was still experiencing the mental health episode. So they told me that they were going to do a safety plan, which means that they're going to let me go. I have to abide by the safety plan that we put in place. And they were just taking like really, really long. And I attempted to leave and two officers followed me out and they're like, hey, Vanessa, come back, you know, let's fill out the safety plan. And unbeknownst to me, everything was already going on in the background. I got handcuffed at the Center for Healthcare Services when I was really supposed to go draw.
Were you dealing with the mental health unit? Was it SAPD that arrested you?
It was actually UTSAPD.
Okay.
That in the initial arrest, it was SAPD. They took me in custody at the Center for Healthcare Services and they took me straight to Laurel Ridge, which is a mental health facility.
Right.
So I spent 4 days under observation at Laurel Ridge. And then upon being released from Laurel Ridge, UTSAPD came, picked me up from Laurel Ridge and then took me straight to jail.
And then you had a bond.
Yes.
Were you still going through the mental health episode at that time?
By that time, no. I think by the time that I got to Laurel Ridge, I was in a different headspace because now they're talking charges and they're talking like, you know, serious talk.
Had you ever been arrested before that?
No, never.
What was your mental state like? First of all, what were you going through at the time? You want to sort of explain what that felt like? And then how would that appear to somebody else that's looking at you from the outside?
So I was experiencing a depressive episode because of Easter Sunday, you know, what had happened. I was crying. I was pacing back and forth, was just nonstop, very fidgety, nonstop. And then when I went into custody at Laurel Ridge, they were talking, you know, charges of terroristic threat. And that's when I was in a different headspace then, because some time had gone by and I was already coming down from the alcohol and coming down from the marijuana. So I was in a different headspace by the time I got to Laurel Ridge. I was much more calmer and willing to accept medication.
Was there any prescribed medication that you were taking at that time?
No.
Did the alcohol or marijuana, either one of them, did they help you in any way when you were going through an episode? Did they make things worse? What was that experience?
The alcohol for sure put me in a different headspace. It's a depressant. I learned that in one of the courses that I had to take under the program that I was in.
It put you in a negative headspace.
Yes, it put me in a very negative headspace.
So generally speaking, alcohol is not the right thing to take when you're going through that type of a mental health episode.
Right.
What about the marijuana? Because, you know, we always hear those stories that in other states or in other countries, marijuana is prescribed for individuals that may have certain diagnoses like bipolar disorder. Did you have any experience with that?
I don't know that it affected it either way. I want to say that, and if it did, it was more the alcohol that had the more pronounced effects.
That makes sense. I'm really enjoying this conversation. Let's do a quick Q&A break. We'll be right back.
This is Q&A with Judge Ron Rankow. Submit your question today at beyondthegavelpodcast.com.
This is a Q&A break. Got a really good question here. I'm going to have to read it out for you. As seen on a few crime TV shows, detectives show up at judges' homes during late/odd hours for a warrant to be signed. Does this happen in real life? If so, what level of crime triggers such a rapid response? There are some times where I'll be at home or I'll be out, And I will get a phone call from a police officer or a detective that says that they need a warrant signed. And generally what that means is there's some emergency where they think there's a felony offense that is in the process of happening. They want to come out and they want to have an opportunity for me to look at a search warrant and give them permission to then search whatever property that it is that they want to look at. Now, that has gone from giving officers the right to do a search of a certain location where crimes are being committed. There have been some human trafficking warrants that I've signed in the middle of the night, or some illegal processes going on, either some drug selling that are large quantities of drugs, or maybe there's some computers that need to be looked at that have evidence of some serious crime that is in the process of being committed. It's actually kind of common for a police officer to call me at 2 or 3 in the morning, or maybe call me the late evening and say, sorry to bother you, there's a warrant. I say, sure. And then we meet somewhere, either wherever I'm at, or we'll drive and meet somewhere. I'll look at it. And the idea there is I'm reviewing a search warrant. I determine whether that search warrant would qualify the officer by law to conduct some sort of search and stop some sort of serious crime that is going on. The types of crimes that police officers feel are somewhat important tend to be the higher level felony offenses. Sometimes there's a murder case that they're investigating and they need to be able to find somebody immediately. Sometimes it's related to a traffic warrant. Maybe a vehicle is stolen or somebody has been kidnapped and there's some cell phone that is located on their person. Those are the kind of cases that will trigger the police officers calling me at all hours of the night. And I'm not the only judge that goes through that. Frankly, every criminal district judge, there are 10 criminal district judges in Bexar County, is open. We rotate that. So we take turns in terms of who is available for police officers on a 24-hour rotation. It's part of our jobs. I enjoy doing it. I always feel like I'm doing something positive and being available to make sure that crimes are being solved at appropriate times. And I always do my best to be available. Anyway, that was a great question. And thank you so much for asking that. We'll be right back.
This is Q&A with Judge Ron Rankow. Submit your question today at beyondthegavelpodcast.com.
Welcome back. I'm here talking to Vanessa Sandoval. She is a recent graduate of our Felony Mental Health Pretrial Diversion Court. So then you were at Laurel Ridge. You were released, picked up by the police.
Yes.
Taken to the Bexar County Jail.
Right.
You went through the magistration process.
Yes.
First time you had ever gone through that.
Yes.
What was that like?
That was very dehumanizing. That's probably the single most dehumanizing experience I've ever had in my life. I was placed on what they call FSP, which is full suicide protection. And what that means is that you do not get anything. They don't give you shoes. They don't give you clothes to wear. You're in a smock. You're lucky if it's a cloth smock and not a disposable smock. Like, I had both. So I had a different experience than the other people that were being magistrated. I could see that. I could tell. I was placed in a cell by myself and I was able to lay down and rest, whereas other people sitting up, they couldn't even like lean their head back because they would get in trouble for it.
At some point, then you went before a judge.
Yes.
You went before a magistrate and that magistrate gave, you know, they read you your rights. This is what you're here for. This is what bond is being set at.
Yes.
Did you have a bond amount?
I don't recall, actually.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
I don't recall.
So at what point was the idea of the Felony Mental Health Pretrial Diversion Court brought up?
My attorney, she told me that it was actually the other side that was recommending me for the program.
It was a prosecutor.
Yes. The prosecutor was recommending me for the program. I was under the impression that it was UTSA, actually.
Uh-huh.
But the other side, whoever the other side may be, that they were recommending me for the Felony Mental Health Pretrial Diversion Program.
And so in your case, I know that, and this is just because I was a judge that handled you in the Felony Mental Health Pretrial Court, there was a communication between the prosecutor and police at UTSA where they made the determination that you might be a good fit for the program. And back then, the program was a lot newer, right? We're only a couple of years old. By the time you joined, maybe we're about 6 to 12 months old as a program. So you're one of the first participants.
Yes.
Were you made aware of that?
No, I wasn't.
And I do recall the very first time I met you, we were in the back doing our staffings, and we set our staffings for an hour. And so for folks to know what a staffing is you have all the members of the specialty court team. You have counselors, you have the prosecutor, you have the pretrial services officer, which is akin to a probation officer before you're put on probation as a condition of bond. You have a defense attorney, you have case managers, who are also speaking on behalf of psychiatrists. And what you do is you go over a case, you go over a certain person, a participant in the program, and everybody gives a little update as to what that person is going through. And sometimes you go through those fast. Sometimes it's one of those, everybody's doing well. And other times they want to talk a little longer about certain people. So it's never a true exact staffings last an hour. Sometimes it lasts longer than that, depending on who's in there on that day. And we were in there, and there was some other case that they were talking about. And I specifically recall the prosecutor bringing up your name, saying there's a new participant, and she's complaining about the judge being late. And I remember in the back going, what? She's like, yeah, that the judge isn't even here yet. And I'm listening to the prosecutor thinking, okay, we're going to have a challenge on our hands with the next person that comes up. Do you recall that day?
I do.
What happened? What happened from your perspective?
From my perspective, I was wondering if you were going to bring that up because I remember my words exactly. I was still, again, you know, this is the beginning of the program. So I have unmedicated mental health, and sometimes I can get a little spicy. And we were asked to be, it was my first time in court, so I had no idea what to expect. I just didn't know what to expect. And we were asked to be there at 2. And I remember I'm sitting there and my anxiety is just rising and rising with each minute that passes by. Huh? I text 2 different people, and me not knowing that they were back there with you. So I text them, I'm unimpressed with the judge's punctuality.
Uh-huh.
That message got back to you. So when it was my turn to...
Well, it was a real time. I mean, when you sent the text, she immediately read it to all of us.
Yes. And I was completely unaware of that she was even in the back with you. Uh-huh. I didn't even know what was going on. I didn't know what a staffing was. I didn't know that a staffing even happened.
Yeah. And I guess because it was your first time, they wanted you to be there early.
Yes. Yeah, so then when you called my name and it was time for me to go up and face you, you brought it up. You mentioned text message that I had sent, you know, laughed it off from there. But and it was the beginning of the program. And like I said, I had a huge chip on my shoulder from the charge in the first place.
Felt like it was unfair.
I did feel like it was unfair.
Right.
So I had a huge chip on my shoulder. And then with the weight and my anxiety just rising, it just was a bad mix.
Did you have an experience with the San Antonio Police Department mental health unit?
Yes.
Because we've been hearing about that in paper. There's been some TV reports on it.
Yes.
It's been well publicized that the city of San Antonio has been focusing a lot on the mental health unit. What was that experience like?
I came on their radar due to the nature of my charge. I came on their radar, and I was on their radar for 14 months. They told me that I would be on their radar for. I had really good experiences with those officers. They're plainclothes officers. They would do follow-up at my house. They would come to visit me at my house to check in, to make sure I was taking my medication and making my appointments for my psychiatrist.
Do you think it's a successful program?
Oh, that's hard to say. That's, I do have my critiques of their unit be not just follow-up, but first responders as well. I personally have never needed them in a first responder situation. And a lot of my frustration and my lashing out when I'm having a mental health episode is with uniformed officers. Uh-huh. So the SAPD mental health unit has never seen me get really aggressive or see a cop in uniform and be triggered and be set off because they're plainclothes officers.
Right.
Now, I know recently in the news, they're facing some scrutiny because of Melissa Perez, who was the 46-year-old woman who was shot and killed by 3 uniformed officers after they had mental health training. And there are questions as to why the SAPD mental health unit weren't there. How come they weren't first responders? And I believe that if they were there, that she would still be alive had that unit had been there.
All right. So let's fast forward a little bit. So you're back at the felony mental health court.
Yes.
You and I are in court for the first time together. We're meeting again. Did you have an understanding as to what it was going to be like for you to be in the court? Did you understand all the rigorous processes that you would have to experience?
No, I didn't understand what I was signing up for.
All you knew is that if you successfully completed, then your case would be dismissed.
Yes.
Because that's the benefit of that court, right?
Right.
You go through the program. If you successfully complete it, then it's dismissed and then expunged or removed from your rest.
In the beginning, because there's different phases to the program, right? There's five different phases to the program. And in the first couple of phases, it's really time consuming. You have all kinds of check-ins. Court seems to be...
It's every week.
Yes, it's every week. Then you have officer that you have to check in with weekly or biweekly. Then you have the case managers. And so it was a lot.
About how much time during a week did it take from you to be in the court? We're talking travel to and from. You had to do UAs.
Yes.
You had to meet with counselors. You had to meet with psychiatrists. But as it relates to the program, there's always this argument that people make that there's a balance of how much time do you force participants to get involved? And at some point, when does it become a detriment to that person? When does it start to hurt them? Because then they can't hold a job, or then they can't take care of their other personal or family obligations. And what was that experience like for you trying to balance all the demands of the program with your personal?
It was challenging. I was fortunate enough to have a job that was really flexible. Mm-hmm. So I had...
What kind of work did you do?
I was a dishwasher at a restaurant. You know, that's whether it's true or not, it's a job that I felt I could get with. Because at the time when I started, I was on ankle monitor. It's one of those jobs where I didn't want to be necessarily in the public's eye. So I would rather be back of house in a restaurant and, you know, do the dishwashing.
Which restaurant was that?
Denny's.
Denny's?
Yeah.
I worked at Denny's when I was in law school. I was a server. And I do recall that Denny's really did well in hiring people that were involved in the system.
Yes.
I remember a lot of folks that I worked with were being dropped off from an Oxford house, whatever they were called back then, a halfway house. Mm-hmm. And I remember some of them had the GPS monitors, but they were working hard trying to make it while their case was pending and going through their treatment. Kudos to Denny's.
Yes.
Denny's has always done that. The tips weren't the best, but, you know, it helped me through law school.
Yeah.
So I was happy to work there. And so they were understanding that you had to go through everything within the program. One of the biggest joys that I have in this program is watching people develop, watching people change, because you mentioned you come to court every week and you and I would see each other and I'd ask you how you're doing after our staffings. And you always had a good smile. You're always very open talking about your case and your progress. And then I'm doing the thing, right? If you look behind me, you see a picture of Martin Luther King Jr.
Yes.
That was Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. was my hero when I was in very early on in junior high and high school. And I was participating in the march.
Yes.
Sort of kind of hidden in the group. And I saw you there with somebody and you guys were there watching the march and a part of it, I'm sure. And,
yes.
And it was great to see you there. Looking back from when you started the program, that very first day that I thought, who is this person talking to me about what I'm doing on my job to today? What are some of the biggest changes that you have seen in Vanessa Sandoval?
My patience. I just think I'm more chill now. I'm more relaxed. Mm-hmm. Whether that's due to the medication or not, I really want to be careful with managing my mental health, because it was my mental health that got me in trouble. Mm-hmm. So being in the program is difficult, but what's even more difficult is being out of the program and not having all of those people to check in on me and to help me along if I need anything. So it's been a challenge, but I think that I'm doing well. I'm, you know, in the expungement process phase of it right now. And once that's all done, then I can look at graduate school again and continue on with life.
So you talked about having a group of people around you that were a support system as part of the program.
Absolutely.
So the cost that the community spends on a mental health court participant versus somebody who's on probation is substantially more than a specialty court. Is it worth it? Is it worth us spending that kind of money for specialty courts perspective?
I think it is. It's, you know, in the beginning, like I said, I had a huge chip on my shoulder and I didn't really fully understand what the program did and what it meant until not even towards the end, but I think listening to, as part of the program, we have to attend the graduations of participants. Mm-hmm. And the testimonies was always one that moved me. The very first time that I heard the testimony from the first graduation that I attended, it really like flipped the switch in me to really look at the program in a different light and utilize the resources that were in front of me. So absolutely, it's worth it. I feel blessed and honored to have this program and to be at this point in the program where I'm graduated and looking at the expungement process, because you're changing people's lives. You know, you're really teaching them about themselves and you're changing people's lives and the opportunities that are going to be available to them. Mm-hmm. So I absolutely like believe in this program.
And in the specialty court program, the underlying cause of those actions there is mental health.
Yes.
If the focus is mental health, theoretically, at some point you can help people get past that. So a big issue that we've always talked about in academia is there's always been a gap between those that are involved in supervision in the criminal justice system or the system, and then moving off of that supervision, there's always that danger point that if you don't follow up with somebody, they're going to revert back to whatever it was that put them there in the first place.
Right.
What do you think of that?
I mean, like I said, I'm trying to be very careful with managing my mental health because I don't want anything to happen to where I end up with a felony again.
Is there assistance out there to help you with that?
I've continued taking my medication. I've continued with seeing my psychiatrist as part of the Center for Healthcare Services. And I'm relying heavily on my coping skills that I learned in the program. Mm-hmm.
Is there anything that you would change about the specialty court program that you went through? It's a tough question, right? Because you're thinking, I don't want to criticize.
Oh, man. You know what? Calling that UA line, I got to tell you, is not my favorite thing.
It's time consuming.
It is time consuming. Mm-hmm. But I understand that it's necessary.
It keeps somebody straight though, right?
Yes, it does.
If they know, because we know that when people are on probation, we know that there's a way that they try to game the way the UAs work.
Yes.
And when they take them.
Yes.
But with the UA call line, it makes it much more difficult.
Yes. Mm-hmm. And the dilutes do not work no matter what the manufacturers have promised. Uh-huh. They definitely know.
They can tell.
Yes. So yes, I had to abide by all the rules and make it through the program as such.
And it also kind of forces you into a compliance mentality, right?
Yes.
Like I have to, like, maybe this is beyond my choice. And in order for me to continue with this program and stay out of prison, I need to follow this.
Yes.
And so that sort of mentality then allows you to let go. Of course, we never want to compare it with any other experience, but there's a lot of programs that deal with that, right? You think of folks that go into the military. You think of folks that learn to let go in life to whatever higher power they believe in, if they believe in one, right?
Right.
That there's a certain letting go and allowing yourself just to go through the things that you have to go through, that you have to learn.
I had to, with the sobriety thing, I had to learn myself sober before doing anything else. And with the coping skills that, you know, were taught in counseling and with our case manager, it was really helpful and beneficial.
I guess that's part of the patience that you're talking about, mm-hmm. right? Learning how to be patient with yourself and with what you're going through.
Yes.
You know, apart from, you know, if I get my case expunged, my life will be better off, you know, I've learned how to manage my mental health. What is it about the system? What is it about the system, right? Because you have a concern about making society better.
Yes.
That's why you have the degrees that you have.
Yes.
Right? Because you care about the world around you and the bigger picture. So what is it about the system that you've learned that you can look back and say, this is what I've got out of it, and this is how I personally, Vanessa, can move the ball forward to make it even better than that?
Well, education is key for sure.
Mm-hmm. That's important, right?
Yes, that is top tier in my mind. I think I had a different idea of what the system did in respect to just disciplining. And now with this program, I see the system can be more rehabilitation, success through rehabilitation. and not just it being done solely through discipline.
You know, and I can see, looking back through the course of history, I can see how we've come to this point from where we were before, right? And both sides of the political spectrum see the advantages of treating people like people, you know, first of all. You know, if you're concerned about people's mental health, if you're concerned about safety in the community, safety starts with the people that are in front of you, right?
Yes.
Safety doesn't necessarily mean incapacitating somebody or taking them out of commission to where they're no longer a part of society. But society, safety in the community means, how do we help people function better to integrate them and their families and the people that they're around them to make society one that is more livable, that is more positive, including all parts of town,
right?
Which you understand that,
yes,
that part of the process. So mental health, I think, is something that we're just now starting to scratch the surface on.
Yes, absolutely.
And you mentioned the stigmas. So it's not just a justice system issue, but it's a cultural issue. Vanessa, I've enjoyed talking to you.
It's been an honor.
Well, it's been my honor. And I'll tell you what I enjoy. You still keep in touch with me.
Yes.
But we still communicate. You let me know how you're doing in terms of your progress. The news has always been good so far. You give me your feedback on the podcast. And I thought having you on would be a great episode.
Thank you.
No, thank you. Any last words that you would have for anybody who may be listening?
Just know that, like I said, don't stigmatize people with mental health disorders. We're out here trying ourselves and trying to live good lives. And yeah.
Yeah. By taking care of people, we make our society a lot better place to be.
Yes.
Thank you for being here. I've enjoyed our conversation. And thank you, the listener, so much for tuning in. We'll be back in 2 weeks.
You've been listening to Beyond the Gavel with Judge Ron Rangel. Join us in the next 2 weeks where we are educating the public and expanding mindsets. Head to our website, beyondthegavelpodcast.com, or your favorite podcast platform to subscribe to the latest episodes and updates.